Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So when Time Warner was close to being split in two last month, just a few years after its famous mega merger with AOL, the move was heralded as a long-awaited rise of shareholder power. The same was said 2 years ago when shareholders led a mass revolt against the merging of Compaq and Hewlett-Packard, which was led by that company's CEO, Carly Fiorina. Do you remember that corporate soap opera? But despite the mass anger, neither of the shareholder-inspired rebellions was successful. Time Warner remains intact, and Compaq was dutifully swallowed up by HP. So if this kind of shareholder action doesn't mean anything, just how democratic is corporate democracy? And is the imperial shareholder any better than the imperial CEO anyway? We're going to get two views on this issue now and ask whether shareholders should have more say in their companies. Arguing one side is Harvard Law professor and corporate governance expert Lucian Bebchuk. He's one of the country's leading advocates for increased shareholder power. Also with us is someone who does not think it's such a good thing for shareholders to have more say, UCLA corporate law professor Stephen Bainbridge. Professor Bebchuk, Professor Bainbridge, welcome both of you to WNYC today. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to be here. Good morning.
So, Lucian Bebchuk, we call it corporate democracy as if the power lies in the hands of the individuals who have a stake in the company. But in reality, corporate boards are under little obligation to take any notice of shareholder votes. How much power does a shareholder really have right now?
In practice, Brian, very little. If you look at the evidence, what I have found is over the last decade, the number of contested elections in which incumbents faced a threat of removal was practically negligible. And a shareholder power to remove director is only in theory there. Practically, it's largely absent.
You wrote a paper where you advocated more shareholder power in general. What power did you propose?
There are two dimensions. One is I would like to make shareholder power to remove directors turn from a fiction into reality. And to get this, we need to make it possible for shareholders to put candidate on the corporate ballot. Listeners might be surprised that under the existing state of affairs, shareholders don't have even this basic right. We need to enable candidates that are successful to get reimbursement of their expenses, because right now they face considerable disadvantage because they have to bear their own costs, whereas the incumbents can fully charge campaign expenses to the company. And lastly, it must be possible for shareholders at some point to replace the full board. Roughly half of the board of public companies are protected by staggered board, which are a very powerful defense against removal.
Professor Bainbridge, corporations are supposed to act for the benefit of their shareholders. Why shouldn't shareholders have more power than they do today?
Well, corporations have never been a democracy. Corporations historically have been characterized by a separation of ownership and control in which shareholders nominally own the corporation, but control is exercised by the board of directors and the managers of the company. And we observe this separation of control going back as far as colonial times in publicly traded companies. And so one of the things we might infer from the fact that this is a centuries-old phenomenon is that there are significant efficiency rationales. To take a simple example, you have a company with 3 million shareholders. How are we supposed to get them into a room and have them have an intelligent discussion of the issues and reach an informed decision? Simple efficiency requires that the vast majority of corporate decisions be made by a smaller, better informed group. And I don't think Lucian disagrees with that. The role of shareholder voting, thus, in some sense, is a question of accountability, of using the voting mechanism not as a decision-making tool, but as a mechanism of holding decision-makers accountable. And the core problem is that the power to hold someone accountable is, in some sense, the power to decide. I use this example in my corporate law class. I say, look, if the dean's sitting in the back of the room, and every time he doesn't like the way I'm teaching, he holds up a sign that says, you're doing a bad job and I'm going to cut your pay, pretty soon I'm teaching in a way that's designed to make the dean happy. And so in some sense, I have transferred the power to decide how I teach to the dean. And so if we think that there's a trade-off between authority and accountability, between the ability of this small group to make decisions and the necessity to hold them accountable, what we're always searching for is the appropriate balance between these two competing goals. And the problem with shareholder voting as a mechanism of accountability is that, number one, as you've pointed out, it doesn't work very well. You know, the recent examples are predominantly examples of failure. Now, that's partly because the current rules are biased against shareholders. But secondly, you know, most shareholders are apathetic. You know, most shareholders know that their vote's not enough, even to affect the outcome of a vote. And even large institutional investors like mutual funds and banks tend to be pretty apathetic.
Let me jump in for a minute.
Well, just one final thought, and then I'll stop. Mm-hmm. The problem then, and this is something where I think Lucian and I are fundamentally in disagreement, is I think the shareholders that are most likely to be activists are the shareholders that are most likely to use activism for private benefit, and that would be groups like union pension funds and state and local employee pension funds.
Let me put out the phone number. Listeners, are you a shareholder? Have you ever voted in a board election, or you just throw those proxies away when you get them in the mail? How much power do you think you have? How much power do you think you should have? Should executives be left alone, basically, to do their job and make more money for you in that way? Does that make more money for you? Do you not want the board standing over the CEO's back like the dean in the back of the room that Professor Bainbridge was just talking about? 212-433-WNYC is our phone number, 212-433-9692. As we discuss the rising debate in corporate America between shareholder power and manager power with Professor Bebchuk from Harvard and Professor Bainbridge from UCLA, 212-433-9692. And Professor Bebchuk, before we go any further, I want to ask you, especially for listeners who are not steeped in this sort of thing, who we're talking about here. That near breakup of Time Warner we talked about was not by an average Joe owning stock. It was the billionaire investor Carl Icahn. But as we become more of a nation of investors with mutual funds and 401ks and everything, and with people's pensions so tied up in this too, is this something the average American has a stake in?
Yes, Brian, I think that we all have a stake in this. Every American who has money in the stock market directly or indirectly and is counting on this for retirement has a stake in companies being run more effectively for their for the long-term value of the owners and in having boards more accountable. I agree with Steve that the main issue is how to ensure accountability. Where I disagree is that I find that right now there is very little accountability because there is really no mechanism that makes directors accountable and ties their interest to the interest of the shareholders. And this is not a product, and again, here I differ from what Steve believes. this is not a product of efficient market forces. This is in part, to a significant extent, a product of legal arrangements that insulate the board and that protect them from shareholder intervention.
Let me take one step back, though, and ask you if you can give us a concrete example where the interests of the CEO and the interests of the shareholders are not in sync. Because, again, I think a lot of listeners who casually own some mutual funds or whatever would think, well, the CEO is hired by the board to make as much money for the company, meaning the shareholders, as they possibly can, and that their interests are aligned. Not true always?
Yeah, let me give you a couple of examples. Many companies have staggered boards, which entrench management. And in a large number of companies, shareholders voted and passed with a majority a resolution to dismantle the staggered board. However, under the existing rules, those resolutions are just advisory, and many boards have elected simply to ignore the resolutions and to continue to maintain this anti-takeover protection.
With the staggered boards, meaning board members aren't all elected at the same time.
Right, and this is generally viewed is a very strong entrenching device. To give another example, many listeners might be surprised to find that if incumbents are on the ballot, and if a shareholder that are given only two options, either to vote in favor or to withhold support, if 99% of the shareholders withhold support and only 1% vote in favor, the directors are going to be elected. And in the Disney case, that was a well-known situation from a couple of years ago, a very large fraction of the shareholders withheld support for Michael Eisner. But given the existing legal rules,
he survived, but then he did wind up having to leave after that vote of non-support, 45%, I think, non-support, a short time later. Professor Bainbridge, we have to take a break in a minute, but do you think that the interests of shareholders are not always served or are always served by CEO, since you're on the CEO power side?
Well, of course not, and I'm surprised that Lucian didn't mention the strongest argument he has, which is CEO compensation, which, you know, he's written a very fine book, Pay Without Performance, in which he documents that there are significant problems with the executive compensation system that show a breakdown between the interests of the CEO and the shareholders. Where Lucian and I might disagree is whether empowering shareholders would be an efficient solution to that problem, but it's certainly a good example of the issue that you raise.
And Lucian is author of a book actually called Pay Without Performance, The Unfulfilled Promise of Executive Compensation. But with that plug, we're going to take a break. We have a lot of people who are shareholders, for the most part, calling in, and CEOs are welcome too at 212-433-WNYC or anyone else in corporate management, 212-433-9692, as we talk about the new debate in corporate America, shareholder versus CEO power. Stay tuned. Brian Lehrer on WNYC inviting you to join me for a live public event next Friday morning, Cities at Risk, The Benefit of Hindsight, next Friday morning, April 7th at 8:30 at the New School. Former FEMA directors Michael Brown and Jamie Lee Witt, who did FEMA under Clinton, plus 9/11 Commission member Bob Carey and others compare notes to learn from the experiences of Katrina and 9/11. Admission is free. Reservations are required. For more information, see the events page at WNYC.org and come out and join us next Friday morning, April 7th at the New School. We continue now on shareholder power versus CEO power with our two guests, Lucian Bebchuk, an advocate for increased shareholder power, Harvard Law professor, also UCLA corporate law professor, Stephen Bainbridge, and Professor Bebchuk, as I just mentioned, is also the author of a book, Pay Without Performance, The Unfulfilled Promise of Executive Compensation. And let's take a phone call. Rona in Nassau, you're on WNYC. Hello, Rona. Rona, are you there?
Alive.
Hi, go ahead.
I read not too long ago about the interlocking directorships, how very few people in the country serve not on one board of directors or two, but maybe 10 or 12, and make a lot of income from that. And I would like both of these people to address whether shareholder power would have anything to do with that.
Professor Bainbridge?
It is certainly true that there have been an awful lot of interest incidents of people serving on multiple boards of directors. Part of the problem are the new rules that the stock exchanges and Congress in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act passed, which require that companies have a majority of their directors being independent outsiders. And companies have not cast a very broad net in selecting those folks. They tend to go to the same people, and so you do have that phenomenon. It's probably a little less common, actually, today than it used to be, though, because those same developments have increased the time demands on directors, and so many directors have cut back some. But having said that, it's not clear to me that shareholder power would have much effect. Shareholders are already told in the proxy statement whether someone is a member of the board of directors of, you know, multiple other companies, and it doesn't seem to affect how shareholders vote on that issue.
Professor Bebchuk, briefly on this, any difference?
Steve is right that shareholders are told, but being told it's not enough. They don't have much choice. Right now, usually there are no competing candidates on the ballot.
Let me go to another caller. Chris in Hoboken, you're on WNYC. Hello, Chris.
How are you doing?
Good.
I just had a question about like the news trend. I used to work for a company called CIA Crop, and what's the influence? Like the example that you gave about the Disney board of directors, I think they were very actively pursuing, you know, the diversification of that board. And, you know, they use their power as a mutual fund to, you know, kind of influence. Is that a new trend for mutual funds to continue to do that? Or
Professor Bebchuk?
I didn't hear the question too well. Can you perhaps repeat it?
The company I used to work for was TIAA Craft, and they had a big influence on, or they were using their shareholder stake to influence, say, the board of directors for Disney to actually not, you know, to maybe diversify the board a little bit more versus, you know.
Actually, let me give this to Professor Bainbridge, because I think this is something that you related to something that you raised before, which is that you think sometimes these big shareholder groups, whether they're pension funds or mutual funds, don't necessarily act even in the shareholders' interest. Why did you say that?
Well, I think TIAA CREF is an example of an activist investor that generally has tried to promote value. But there are other examples that are more troubling. Take, for example, CalPERS. The fellow that was the head
That's a pension fund in California?
That's the biggest pension fund in the world, actually. It's the California Public Employee Retirement System.
Right.
The fellow who was the head of the board of trustees of that organization also happened to be the president of the union that was locked out by Safeway in a collective bargaining dispute, and he tried to get CalPERS use its power to vote the CEO of Safeway off the board of directors and to make a shakeup in the board that would bring in a pro-union board of directors. And this is a particularly egregious example of the way that institutional investors can use their powers to pursue an agenda of sort of private benefit, something that benefits themselves but not shareholders generally.
So, Professor Bebchuk, what about that as an argument against more shareholder power?
I think the fear of special interest is not a basis for insulating a board from shareholders. And the reason is that in the end, even though shareholders with special interests can propose something, nothing can pass without majority support among the shareholders. And if you look at the type of proposals that shareholders have passed over the years, they are all proposals that are viewed by financial institutions at large as serving shareholder interests. Those are not proposals that serve some special activist or social agenda.
But how much influence do the pension companies have in this? I gather that one of the leaders in the campaign for more shareholder power, talking about the public sector pension funds, is in fact AFSCME, the American Federation of State and County and Municipal Employees, the union. So how would companies operate differently if groups like this had more control?
Well, AFSCME is not going to have control. If you look at the proposals that unions are putting forward, some of the proposals, those that seek to restrict executive compensation below a certain level, get minimal support. Some proposals that they happen to bring, but that have wide support among mutual funds, do pass. So we should not confuse the identity of the initiator with whether this serves shareholders at large. The only things that get passed are the proposals that have very widespread shareholder support.
Professor Bainbridge, do you disagree?
Well, it's certainly true that under the current regime, the proposals that pass tend to be ones that have widespread support. Of course, one of the things Lucian wants to do is to change the current regime to further empower shareholders. And you might observe, if shareholders had more power, that an institution pursuing some sort of private benefit might bundle together a popular proposal with a private benefit proposal. More importantly, I think even though Lucian's right that under current law it tends to be the case that popular proposals are the ones that pass. Suppose I'm AFSCME and I want to see some change at a company that would benefit workers, but maybe not shareholders. And I go to the management and I say, okay, I've got one of these proposals, maybe a proposal to eliminate takeover defenses, that's very popular and likely to pass, and I'm going to put it on your shareholder ballot using an SEC rule that lets shareholders make proposals and put them up for a vote. I'm going to do that unless you agree to do the following things that are completely unrelated to shareholder value but are good for employees. And so that gives these private interest activists, if you will, leverage that would only increase under Lucian's proposals.
This is 93.9 and AM 820 WNYC and WNYC.org. We're talking about the growing debate in corporate America between shareholder power and CEO power or manager power generally. My guests are Lucian Bebchuk, Harvard Law professor and advocate on this program today for increased shareholder power, and someone who doesn't think it's such a good idea for shareholders to have more say, UCLA corporate law professor Stephen Bainbridge. Our phone number, 212-433-WNYC. And Jim in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Jim.
Yes, good morning. First of all, as I told the screener, I was at the Time Warner meeting when they did the merger with AOL, and I had stood up.
When they did the merger or when they were considering undoing the merger?
No, you had to be voted on anyway. You had a special stockholder meeting for that merge. And I went to it, and I had owned stock in both Time Warner Warner Communications since its inception, and I've been to that stockholder meeting probably 20 times.
Uh-huh.
And AOL was, it was, the whole thing was basically preposterous because I had owned AOL stock. It was an immensely vulnerable stock. And I stood up and I said, this doesn't make any sense to allow a company that's so volatile to buy a huge company, or actually they were, actually they won't be the owner of the company after the merger took place. And there were about maybe, I say, 10 of us that protested the thing. And it, and as I've told your screener, all this stuff was pre-done. The problem is that so many mutual funds own millions and millions of shares of this stock, and everything's been, the deal has been cut before they even go to the meeting. So it doesn't mean anything, just except for the fact they have to do it, I guess, by law. And another example, many times they've had, or for Time Warner at least, they've had proposals by the stockholders to, like, use more recycled paper and things like that. That stuff's all, it doesn't mean anything because all Time Warner has to do is say, well, that's going to cost us money and that's going to do this, that, and the other. And so, they contact the mutual funds and nothing happens. So I don't see how, unless you changed it so that certain percentage of people that buy a mutual fund would be given an opportunity to vote on the issue, nothing will ever change.
Professor Bainbridge, do you agree?
Oh, he's absolutely right. One of the problems with Lucian's proposal, and one of the reasons I'm against it, is that you can basically divide shareholders into three groups. Individual investors who are mostly apathetic, tend not to vote, or if they vote, they tend to vote the way, you know, they just go the management line. Secondly, the sort of activists, unions, pension funds we've been talking about. And then the third and far and away largest group are insurance companies, banks, mutual funds. And one of the things about those investors is that their voting is never likely to become an effective accountability mechanism because they all do business with corporate management. They provide 401ks, they provide loans, they have a host of relationships with corporate management, and they're not going to bite the hand that feeds them. And so you've got two groups that are basically going to be either overtly pro-management or at least apathetic, and a third group that's going to be more concerned with politics and unions and so forth. And so you really don't have anybody who's representing the quote-unquote average Joe shareholder.
Professor Bainbridge, the billionaire investor Warren Buffett recently spoke out against current practices regarding executive pay. Here's some of what he said. Quote, "Too often executive compensation in the U.S. is ridiculously out of line with performance. Huge severance payments, lavish perks, and outsized payments for ho-hum performance often occur because comp committees have become slaves to comparative data. These costs are now being incurred in amounts that will cause shareholders to earn far less than they historically have." Do you agree?
Well, there's absolutely no question that the executive compensation system at many companies is inconsistent with shareholder interests. And, you know, that's I think everyone more or less agrees with that. You know, the question is, how do you fix it? And what I've not been persuaded by is the argument that empowering shareholders is the way to fix it for the reasons that we've already been discussing. I think that what has to happen is that boards of directors through independent comp committees have to be empowered to weigh in more effectively. I think that media scrutiny has helped. I think that the regulatory scrutiny has helped. But at the end of the day, the question is, how do you fix it? And the question is whether shareholder empowerment would be a useful fix. And I, as I say, for the reasons we've been discussing, I think the answer to that is probably no.
And Professor Bebchuk, after Enron and WorldCom imploded, taking millions in shareholder dollars with them, Congress passed the Sarbanes-Oxley law to impose tighter regulations on public companies. But that law was more about disclosures than empowering shareholders in any way, right? Why did they leave out that aspect?
That aspect was not in the heart of the scandals, and they focused on the disclosure issues, which were most salient in the scandals. But they left a major part of corporate governance untouched. And here, what I think listeners should think about is that notwithstanding all the imperfections of the owners, of the shareholders that Steve was talking about, the question is whether leaving boards completely unaccountable is an acceptable alternative. You know, Churchill once remarked that democracy is the worst form of government, except all those other forms that have been tried from time to time. And I think the same can be said about corporate governance, that having the owners have the power to replace the board and make some decisions might be an imperfect monitoring mechanism, but it's better than leaving boards largely unaccountable.
So we've heard your disagreements on that point, but Professor Bainbridge, how would this change even come about? Would the Securities and Exchange Commission have to make a rule change, or would it be state legislatures, or can shareholders just introduce their own resolutions to increase their own power?
Well, it could be a mix of all of those. We observe, for example, shareholders putting forward proposals to require majority rather than plurality voting in the board of directors. We observe the SEC considering proposals to empower shareholders to nominate directors in a way that doesn't exist under current law. I think a lot of the change, though, would have to come at the federal legislative level through Congress.
And on that point, Professor Bebchuk, will end with you because we're almost out of time. When it comes to lobbying Congress, we know there are corporate lobbyists, but are there any lobby groups for shareholders?
Well, it seems that the power of vested interest is now, in the end, fairly strong against reform. And the farther away we get from the scandals, the less public pressure there is for a fundamental reform. But we should keep trying and keep hoping.
Yeah, well, maybe the Enron trial being in the news will put the fire back in the belly of someone on that. I guess that remains to be seen. Lucian Bebchuk, law professor at Harvard. Stephen Bainbridge, law professor at UCLA. Thank you both very much for joining us and talking about corporate democracy.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and coming up in a minute, we go from the boardroom to the Union Hall. Did you hear that the AFL-CIO is splitting with most members of the Democratic Party and opposing a guest worker program now? We'll talk to someone from the Labor Federation in a minute. Stay tuned.